So back at the studio in Los Angeles, Nathan, who's running the show tonight, says, "Well, why not lead off with a little bittersweet symphony, right? Great song." And I said yes immediately because it fit in actually perfectly with the book, The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. One of the questions that Dr. Seth Horowitz will address tonight is, why are there earworms? Why are there certain songs that you can't get out of your mind? Why are there not, and here's my question, why are there not nose worms? Certain smells that just come back to you during the day. And maybe there are. I've just never experienced them. Not like I do with earworms, where you literally can't get a song out of your head. Or for that matter, eye worms, which just sounds gross no matter what, even if you're being just figurative. Some where like an image would just keep flashing in front of your eyes. Now that may exist for some people, but for most people, it's just an earworm thing. We'll find out more about that. We're talking about how hearing shapes the mind. Last hour, we were talking with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake about the difference between science and religion and how science has created its own dogma, its own religion, and in many ways can't break free of that to find new and interesting things in science. But here's one thing that both science and religion can agree on is, depending on, of course, now whom you ask, but for many people, either way, the universe began with a noise. The universe began with a noise in the Big Bang Theory. And the universe begins with a noise in the Bible when God spoke and said, "Let there be light." And there was light. But light wasn't first. The words were. The sound was. We'll pick it up right there. The universal sense, how hearing shapes the mind, how, for that matter, hearing has shaped evolution, shaped us into who we are today. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Seth Horowitz has a very interesting career besides being a neuroscientist and an assistant research professor at Brown University. I like what you write about this little side business you got going with your wife, where you guys fly around the world and record stuff. Talk about that a little bit.
Okay. Well, I met my wife about 7 years ago, and we met because we were both interested in acoustics. She was a sound artist, and I had never actually never heard of that before, and I had to go and look it up, see
So
what
when we call that radio people, like she's like in radio, right? Kind of. I mean, we're sort of like sound artists in our own little way.
Well, yeah, but you're artistic in your medium. What she does is she actually creates sculptures with sound.
Oh,
And
it's beautiful.
it was something that I should have thought about because what she's doing is rather than taking physical matter and taking up space that lasts over time, she was using matter being displaced by energy at specific rates over time. So she would create these specific sounds that would be triggered only when you entered a specific place. Or one of her more fascinating sound sculptures that she presented at the Acoustical Society of America several years back, where she took we went ahead and recorded a pool game with microphones put in the pockets, under the table, and on top, so that you got multiple levels of sound, people talking, the sounds of the pool balls, and set up the speakers in the places of the pockets so that you walk through the sound of a pool ball and
Yeah, I love that.
the sound so that it felt like you were the ball or about to be hit by the ball.
Yeah, that's really
And
cool.
so we ended up just working on a lot of projects together. And so we're both fascinated by sound, and the only thing we argue about is access to the soldering iron.
Well, that sounds like love. And it kind of reminds me of what they do at the Science Museum here in the Twin Cities. And I know this is a very, rudimentary version of what you're talking about, but I do love the fact that, all of the steps are notes to and so you go up and down the stairs and they make the sound of notes or piano keys being struck, and I think that's really cool.
Oh, it is. I mean, it gives you that tie between space and sound. The two are
Yeah.
incredibly interrelated, even in our brains, and not just from having fun making noise.
Well, we're gonna answer some fun questions tonight. The book is The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. And we will get into that question about earworms, those songs you can't get out of your head. We'll get to that coming up. But I also want to ask you about fingernails on the chalkboard. But let's pick it up kind of where I threw it there toward the end about the idea of the universe. The whole history of the universe really starts with sound. And I like when you're talking a little, especially about some of the biological evolutions of creatures that have sound, or what that it really comes down to is it's not just things that you hear, but it's just vibrations that we feel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, anywhere that there's energy and matter that interact, you're going to end up with vibration. Now, sound is what we call the vibrations that we hear, but we also perceive them through substrates. Even sitting on a chair, a train goes by, a truck goes by, you feel it in non-auditory structures. You feel it in your butt, you feel it in your feet. Go to a concert for the deaf, and the loudness, people who are deaf can't hear through their ears, but they feel it in their body. So that vibration is almost everywhere in the universe. And there is everything, you discussed the concept of the sound of the Big Bang that started everything. And people who have studied the microwave background, that's what's left over from the initial explosion that formed the universe, have sonified it. And it's on the web, and you listen to it, and it sounds so mournful. It's almost like the universe has had second thoughts about the whole thing.
Who can blame it?
Yeah, there are days like that. But sonification, bringing vibration well below our hearing into the human hearing range, is a really powerful tool, and sometimes it doesn't get used often enough. I think in science, there's a certain degree of purity when we want to measure a sound. We want to keep it exactly where it is so that I can show you a spectrogram or an oscillogram of what a bat or a dolphin call is, but you couldn't possibly hear it. Likewise, I could show you just the vibrations of the Eiffel Tower or the rumbling of an elephant. But in order to hear it, you sonify it. You shift it up into the human range because we're interested in the human experience. And so there's nothing wrong with doing this. It's a way of expanding our own sensory systems into worlds that we can't perceive otherwise.
Yeah, I was thinking of you last hour. There was a story, it's on our website tonight at coasttocoastam.com, about this West Seattle hum.
I heard about that.
Yeah, and this is right now the culprit is suspected to be fish.
Midshipman fish, yes.
Yeah, and that they are vibrating at a certain level, and because there are enough of them, and because they are close enough in proximity, that somehow it's being picked up, which leads me to wonder then, again, after having read especially the opening chapters in The Universal Sense, about the amount of animal noise that's being made right now that we either can't hear because it's not in our human range, or it just gets made, but there aren't quite enough of them to make, you know, sort of to rise above the level where we can start to perceive it. And I'm sort of curious to see what, because I know you also go around and you record things and stuff. So, hums like this totally would drive the average person just about crazy to be having to hear that all the time. And yet maybe that's going on all the time in nature, and it's just barely out of our range.
Oh, definitely. I mean, one thing that I have some question about this, because I've heard midshipman calls, and they are loud fish, and is this, and to them, it's a love song. And another male comes along, and the first male tries to out-hum the first one, so the second one will get a little louder, and will shift their pitch a little bit, so they're not quite overlapping. And what happens is the two sounds start beating together, and it can get incredibly loud. One thing people don't realize is that, even though, you know, we know intellectually that the world is mostly under the ocean, but the ocean is underwater is very, very noisy.
Hmm.
It seems a little counterintuitive.
No, I know. You're talking about some shrimp or something in the book, weren't you?
The snapping shrimp are incredible animals. They have this giant claw that snaps closed so quickly it makes this incredibly loud click, like 100 decibels, which is like a gunshot. And it's so rapid that they actually give off little tiny bursts of light when the bubbles pop, moving their claws through the water.
That's so cool.
And they're all over the West Coast. But there are a lot of sounds that we aren't aware of because they happen underwater, and it's very hard for sound to get from underwater to the air. There's there's a difference at the boundary between air and water that creates high impedance, which is like resistance. The sound wants to bounce off the surface and keep going through the water. Some animals that make sounds, like sperm whales, actually use differences in temperature in the ocean to bounce their sound between two temperature layers so they can get their one call to travel hundreds of miles. Hmm. But most of that sound will never make it to where we will hear it unless we go underwater or drop hydrophones in. Now, the midshipman might be a good match for the frequency, but I doubt it's coming out of the water. I think what's probably happened is, since they tend to be around nooks and crannies and there's a lot of piers in the area, what may be happening is that piers and metal structures and continuous parts of the ground are making human artifacts vibrate in synchrony with it.
Mm-hmm. So the fish are vibrating the piers, you know, or whatever.
The only thing I can think of, because it's not too likely that we're hearing the sound directly from the water. The water is still, it tends to trap its own sound, as you know, tell if you stick your head in the bathtub.
Sure, sure. Well, that's very interesting. What a great observation. And yet, whether it's that or whether it's the sound of, you know, so many of these cities have reported similar things where, and they never were able to determine where the hum came from. But outside in rural Pennsylvania and rural Texas, two places where the sound, the sound is prominent. It's recordable, for God's sakes, but they can't find where it comes from.
There's a good chance. Well, part of the problem is that we think of the speed of sound as being something fixed. It's, you know, like you see lightning, 5 seconds later, you hear thunder and you know it's about a mile away. But sound changes in speed depending on the density of what it's traveling through. So it's about 5 times faster in water and about 10 times faster in the ground. So if you have some vibrational source, it's traveling 10 times faster than it is in the air. It becomes very, very hard to localize where it's coming from. One thing that I noticed in my travels with my wife, when we run around, we tend to go to a city, slap binaurals in our ears, turn on the recorders, and just wander. And each city has its own noise bands, its own sounds. And I spent most of my life in New York City. And when I went back to record, I hadn't really noticed, but the noise band levels, even in Central Park, which is relatively quiet, is really different from where I'm living now in Rhode Island. Yeah. And part of the difference is the amount of traffic and the type of asphalt that is used. When I went to Venice, and I went because my wife was in a show there, doing a sound piece, of course. And we got there, and there's 10,000 people in San Marco Plaza, and it was still one of the quietest cities I'd ever heard because I could tune out the people. But normally, I'm very aware of the low frequency, the vibration. Venice, there's no roads for vehicles. And all the buildings, well, most of the buildings, are made of this very porous limestone, which acts like acoustic tiling. So each city, because of its traffic, because it's sitting on rock or a lot of asphalt, acts as a low fidelity speaker. And so every area will have its own native sound. And some areas, I suspect, are very densely packed and are propagating collections of sound, whether from very deep in the earth or possibly even from human noise far away.
Or the mole men. Or mole men, which we...
Are we talking about the mole men from Superman, from
I don't know, Deadpool,
or from Sam and Max?
From wherever they come. But it kind of makes you wonder sometimes whether even we understand everything that's happening underground yet. And that's where, again, where some of these noises might be totally natural, but who knows how or how long it'll be or what the circumstances will be that will lead us to discover their origin.
Oh, there are some really well-known and very mysterious sounds. Most of them from under the ocean. Probably the most famous is called the bloop. And you can find it on a lot of different websites. And what it is, it was, I believe, from a Navy recording site, but I have to double-check.
Sounds right.
They could never figure out where it was.
I remember this, yep.
Yeah, and it just went bloop. But at the last, I said it must have been very deep and incredibly loud, and no one has ever figured out what it is. People have talked about some submerged, a very deep diving whale, a gas release from under some human vehicle. No one knows. The oceans, you know, this is almost a cliche now, but it really is true. The oceans are even less understood than outer space.
And it's hard to imagine that that's true, even with the amount of research and now these new James, you know, Cameron-like submarines that are going so far down, as you know, all the robots, all the other things. And we do, I think the it may be the case where the more we discover, the more we realize how little we know. And,
exactly.
Yeah, how frustrating that is. Well, the universal sense, again, talks about hearing and how it's also shaped us as a society. Let's talk a little bit about that, because the I kind of love that idea that sound as a survival skill, I guess we'll never know. Maybe we'll, you know, the dinosaurs, the few dinosaurs that popped up that were unable to detect sound or make a noise may not have been around for very long. You know, the just if we look at evolution, the great advantage often is either both great hearing or be great vocalization, and maybe both at the same time.
Well, it's pretty unlikely any dinosaurs were unable to hear. There's a lot of variability in what they hear, and they're very large animals, so it was probably biased to low frequency, but there were a lot of small dinosaurs, too, that probably heard a much higher frequency sound, although the one limitation is that mammals seem to have evolved a system that lets animals hear the highest frequency sounds. So small dinosaurs might have heard something on the level of, let's say, some of the better hearing birds. And that cuts off at 12 kilohertz. Humans, when they're very young, hear 20 kilohertz. At my advanced age of 50, I still have good high frequency hearing because I have strange ears, but most people at my age don't hear too well above probably 15, 16,000 cycles per second. And there isn't too much relevant sound as bass sounds at that level, but there's an awful lot of harmonic information up there that is quite important to perception, and you lose that as you get older. I think that hearing has definitely driven our evolution. Animals that have had better hearing, especially small animals that are not necessarily the big carnivores, that could hear the bigger or better hunting animals are going to pass on their genes. Whereas if you have kind of sloppy hearing, or right, you have a predisposition to go deaf very early, you're probably going to get chewed up and not pass your genes.
And yet the other part of that, though, is animals that are able to vocalize danger to the other members of their species, and therefore that too is its evolutionary advantage.
Right. That means that's a social signal. I mean, you could argue that if you're about, you know, if you're running around in wherever your habitat is, and all of a sudden you see a predator, maybe the smart thing to do is hide and shut up. But if you're a social animal, it's just as important for other members of your group to be able to pass on their genes, because they're probably related to you. So
sure,
giving a signal is actually helping you survive, because it's also presumed that if they see something, they'll warn you.
Right.
There's some wonderful studies on this in primates, the Seyfarth and Chaney stuff, with the vervet monkeys giving specific calls for snakes, for hawks, you know, for animals of different types, saying, so basically warning, look out in the grass, look up in the tree, and even knowing which animal gives the call gave them some idea of the reliability. That's Bob again, he's an idiot, ignore him, versus,
right,
okay, Joe knows what he's talking about, everyone get in the tree.
Right.
Even chickens do this. And it was just Peter Marler, who's one of the gods of animal behavior, gave this wonderful talk. He starts off with a slide of chickens. It's like, this isn't an animal, this is dinner. And
yeah,
he pointed out that chickens have specific alarm calls that are shaped to warn other animals in the area. So if you had a ground-based raccoon, and they would show a picture of a raccoon on the side, and the chicken would run around screaming. But you put the shadow of a hawk on, all of a sudden, it would lay down on the ground, give out this very soft hiss that wouldn't spread very far. The chicken was using appropriate vocalization to warn the other members of the extended chicken family that,
right,
specific danger involved.
Yeah, and maybe at the same time, get the hawk to go after the squirrel, too. So let's pick up this thought here in just a second. We'll answer the chalkboard question as well as the earworm question next on Coast to Coast. What is it about earworms? Let's address that coming up next. Songs that just get stuck in your head, the universal sense, Dr. Seth Horowitz explains next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. I'm like one of the most susceptible person to earworms. I don't know what it is about them. And I have a million of them in my head. My wife says I don't even know how often I just say things that are clearly a reflection of something that's... She said, because I forget, she said, you know, that's the 15th time today you've said X. And it'll be the 15th time that I said, we are farmers. Bum, 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 bum. TV commercial that's on right now. And it's a great earworm. And it's a fabulous jingle. And yet, it's so weird. That it's why is it an audio phenomenon more than it ever is any of the other senses?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that sound coordinates so well with all the other senses at a subconscious and conscious level. I mean, if you hear a song and you like it, you can say, okay, it's gone. But if it has a very identifiable series of pitches and it's the bridge is relatively short, something can just fit into your short-term memory, which is, you know, 7 ± 2 elements. So it's like most earworms start off with a few notes and then you remember the rest of it. And it's also about timing. If it's something that you can tap your fingers to or tap your foot to, if you can start having all of these different elements, timing, pitch, memory, and being able to tie it in with motor, you start getting these loops going from the brainstem to the cortex, within the cortex, tying together a lot of things. It might just be one loop, but if it's something that you hear over and over again, which is what usually triggers an earworm,
right,
repetition, you start, every time a neuronal circuit fires, it changes itself. You repeat something, you actually, the neurons that are involved with it will physically reconfigure themselves to make it easier for them to fire in the same way again. This is called Hebbian learning. It's a very simple form of neural learning. This is why everything that affects you actually physically reconfigures your brain. If you hear a song and you have an emotional response to it, not just something you walk through as you're going down a corridor, but you thought, that's kind of fun, or you've heard it 10 times that day, or it's been on the television constantly, you've had this repetition. You've got this little circuit that started going, and a good jingle or a good song will have something that's catchy, not just for the sound, but for how it ties together the rest of your brain. I mean, your brain is really a pattern-seeking machine, like a wet drum machine.
That's funny.
Always looking for patterns. And we also get very upset when something violates the pattern, which can lead us over to the fingernails on the blackboard phenomena. But a successful earworm will be something that ties in, the ease of remembering something and transferring it from short-term to long-term memory will be relatively simple, and it will be something that ties in potentially your motor systems, being able to tap that out again.
I love that idea of it being sort of a loop feeding through different parts of the brain, tying it together. That in a way, then, earworms serve a function.
In a way, they're a form of memorization. And if you think about it, how do people coordinate activity? Let's say early days of humanity before there was formal language. How would you coordinate hauling the mastodon across, carcass across the rocks? One theory is that you come up with synchronized vocalization. 1, 2, 3, pull. 1, 2, 3, pull. Even that kind of rhythm doesn't require linguistic content. It's basically telling you, move now, move now, move now. So it's a very, very basic system for coordinating within yourself, maintaining a constant rhythm, and for communicating the need for constant rhythm in some kind of behavior amongst a group. Now, of course, it's what everyone's searching for in advertising. It's come up with a jingle that'll stick in your head. And
right.
I still remember the ads from the 1960s. Unfortunately, I still remember most of the cigarette ads from the 1960s because
sure.
They're on television all the time.
Well, and I think that's the interesting thing. I work within the church, and I frequently visit people who are in nursing homes, and they can still sing, a Bible lesson they learned when they were 7 years old. They may not be able to remember what they ate for lunch or what the name is of their roommate, but they can remember something because it came to them in song. because, you know, they all stood up there. And for whatever reason, that just reinforces it's like the first memories we have are the last ones we lose. Yeah. And those first memories are often musical.
Right. The tonal quality adds something. I mean, the words are hard. Evolutionarily, they're very new. They are dependent on specific structures. Tones are not. Tonal processing is very, very old. It's right down in the brainstem. And it also happens incredibly fast. Even humans who are not particularly specialized for hearing start processing in 50,000 and identifying sounds in 50,000 of a second.
Huh.
Way down in the brain as soon as the stuff gets in through the ear. So it happens very quickly. It goes through very old school parts of the brain and loops through the highest centers. So when you link words to music, you suddenly have a very powerful memory driver. But
right.
Then again, how many people actually properly remember the lyrics to a lot of songs?
Right, or ever heard them, ever understood them in the first place, not even
right.
Remembered them, even bothered to sort them out. I mean, they just hear a bunch of vowel sounds and some consonants, but they
right.
Don't necessarily
bad.
Process
ECR.
What they're hearing.
There's a bad moon on the rise. A lot of people notice there's a bathroom
right.
On the right.
Right, exactly.
They don't care, you know?
Right. Still a good song.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I'm sure you've seen this, where the garages, public garages or something, will have a song that's playing at every level
mm-hmm.
of the garage, because they can use all the colors. You're on the purple floor. You know, they can put up purple four, but until they have purple four and they're playing the theme from Carousel, you know, suddenly people can't remember the purple. They can't remember the four, but they can remember when they actually ask them, what song do you remember hearing earlier tonight? Oh, it's that song from Carousel. Oh, you're on level four. And they weren't even conscious of inputting mm-hmm. it. Right.
I've never actually experienced that, but that's brilliant.
Oh yeah, no, there's a place near my house. They have show tunes on every level, and I hate show tunes. But gosh, I never forget where my car's parked.
Yeah. I'm afraid my mother was a show tune freak, so unfortunately,
yeah.
I remember every one of them from the 60s and 70s.
I bet. Well, it's funny. Like, I'll give you another example. You know. I'll give the melody. You see if you can name the jingle. Okay.
Okay.
Da 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 da.
Oh Lord, yes. Wait.
Da 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 da.
I recognize it, and I cannot remember the product.
Okay.
Which means it wasn't a good placement, but
I don't know. American Family Insurance.
Okay.
It's just been their little jingle. American Family Insurance. And they've been running it forever. And they recently pulled it in favor of a song from an artist from American Idol.
Big
and it's a great
mistake.
Song. Great song, but I think it's a big mistake too. And it contemporizes their image and it's they use the song well and everything, but I can't see, I don't, if you play that those little notes for me, I picture the little roof of the house next to the American Family jingle, you know, I could picture the logo just from that. And I don't know if it's going to be as effective with this new campaign. And I think that's the hard part. If you can get people to remember something based on sound, you've really gone, you've achieved something.
Well, this is why, here's the one that I'm sure you'll know and probably will make most people want to hate me, which is da 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 da, T-Mobile.
Right.
The first ringtone that interrupted everybody's dinner.
True.
And it was one of the most successful and recognizable sounds ever. And it was developed by my friend Lance Massey, who works with me in Neuropop.
Really?
And it was based on, I mean, he came up with this, but it was based on our early conversations about how psychophysics works. Because he was given a visual logo. The early logo for when it was Deutsche Telekom was five pink squares, I think, and a gray one. It could be the other way around. I don't have it in front of me. And they said, we need an audio logo. And Lance, who's slightly synesthetic, just looked at it and said, okay, so it's note, 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 higher note, lower note. And it went da, 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 although he insists it's Beethoven's Fifth sideways.
That's funny.
But by merging the visual logo with the audio logo, he got a lock.
Yeah.
And everybody knew that sound and that logo.
So again, just to recap then, earworms are they are loops that our brain creates, partially because it helps to connect all of our brain parts together, but also because it kind of runs through the brain at different intervals. Because why does it keep coming back and back and back?
Because most earworms are something that's been repeated over and over again so that you've actually formed a circuit for it. And in addition, the most successful ones are usually at rates that are very human. They are at rates that you can tap your fingers to, that you can easily recognize the sound, and they tend to be restricted in the number of notes. So you can fit them into short-term memory, but they get passed to long-term memory very easily. So it's like somebody, a very experienced juggler, who only has to juggle 3 or 4 balls. It's like, this guy knows the juggling, throw 4 balls at him, we'll have him going around in a circle for her. If you then throw someone 12 other chainsaws and throw a couple of bowling balls to the mix, it's not going to stick so well. So if you give somebody a really complicated musical piece, that's not going to be a good earworm. Although it can get triggered by something simpler. You can have a very simple lead into something, and then all of a sudden you'll remember the rest of the song.
Well, that might explain why the best antidote for an earworm, in my experience, is the hair of the dog that bit you. Go back and actually listen to the whole song, not just that one little piece. And it tends to...
It relieves tension.
Yeah, it knocks it out, because now I'm hearing the whole song, not just that one little piece again. So.
And, this isn't a modern phenomenon. One of my favorite Mark Twain stories was called Punch in the Presence of the Passenger, where the train people used to walk through giving the prices of the tickets. And it was this little song, and Mark Twain heard it, and he's sitting on the train and noticed that the wheels of the train are moving at the same rhythm as this little song that the train conductors were singing to tell you how much your ticket was. And he got stuck in his head. And he found out the only way he could get rid of it was by telling it to somebody else and having it get stuck in their head. So he describes this auditory plague that he just passes on from person to person.
It's funny, like a yawn. So is that why then, is if I'm to pick up on something you mentioned a few minutes ago, is that why we so hate the fingernails on the chalkboard?
Well, the fingernails on the chalkboard is a really complicated phenomenon. For me, it's metal rake on concrete. It just goes through certain songs, sounds really go through you. And there's been a lot of theories about it. The first time it was really addressed was by a paper by Halpern in 1986. Which has a great title of The Psychoacoustics of a Chilling Sound, where they studied people's responses to styrofoam on a balloon, fingernails on a blackboard, metal rake on concrete, and basically had people rate how much they really hated the sounds. And the theory was that these sounds were in a frequency range that overlapped primate alarm calls, kind of baby screaming sounds. And we all know how much we love screaming babies, especially in airplanes or restaurants. It's just the sound just gets right into you and goes right through you. The problem is, as many scientific studies don't get replicated, even though at the heart of science you're supposed to get a finding, you're supposed to test it again. It doesn't happen that often, especially when you have a successful, highly cited study. And it still hasn't been tested to date. So I did kind of an ad hoc thing with a student who was working in the lab, where I was interested in the idea of, is it really this frequency band? So what we did was we took fingernail on a blackboard sound and we mapped it on the structure of it, the fine changes in the timing. We mapped it onto musical sounds, onto vocal sounds, onto noise. And the basic finding was that it wasn't the frequency content. It wasn't this primate alarm call frequency. It was rather the fact that it was what's called pseudo-periodic. It's like most sounds that we like hearing, most vocal sounds, the sounds of someone's voice, the sounds of a good, well-tuned musical instrument, are very periodic. They're harmonic. They're mathematically regular. They sound smooth. What happens with fingernails on a blackboard is if you get this pseudo-random variation, so that instead of going you're going very quickly, and just enough to make everything off. So it seems to be a timing thing, but I sort of recognized the pattern, and one of the patterns that I recognized was looking at a graph of someone who was screaming at the top of their lungs. And someone screaming at the top of their lungs, the vocal folds that make our sounds, that usually make very harmonic sounds, if you scream, you're blowing air past them faster than you can really keep up with. And so you get all these little pseudo-random variations. And it just seems to send a signal right into your brain that someone, or this sound, represents someone screaming in horrible pain or terrible fear. It's just a very simple aspect of the sound that gives it a tremendous emotional response.
You know, the idea of that, that we hear these things and we think immediately or consciously or unconsciously that somebody is in trouble or that we are in trouble and this is our warning sign. I think we all have that kind of physical, we tighten up when we hear the sound, almost as though it's like a fear reaction as opposed to just a, God, I hate that reaction. Because there's a lot of things I hate. I mean, and I don't have the physical reaction that I do when I hear fingernails on a chalkboard.
It's something that just gets right down to the very primitive survival areas. I mean, sound is your survival instinct. You know, you go to sleep, you close your eyes, your ears are still on. Some people, like my wife is one of those blessed people who can sleep all the time. I have alarm ears, on the other hand, but something, a loud noise happens, we both wake up. She's just smart and goes back to sleep immediately because she realizes I was just the cat deciding that he wants to play. I'm going, okay, there's a monster in the house. And, you know, I've just had alarm ears since I was a kid. But we both wake up. Everyone's ears are on even when you're asleep.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
So it's an alarm system.
I suffer from a pretty disruptive case of tinnitus.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's
really bad. Thank you. It is bad. And what's really interesting about it is, I mean, there's certain things I can do, and I'm going through a lot of intensive therapies to try to minimize the sound and to redirect my attention away from it, all the things that can possibly be done. But one of the things it does do is it infiltrates my dreams all the time.
Yeah.
And really, that's the part that's so annoying. It's even when I'm asleep, technically I shouldn't even still be hearing it. And yet it finds a way eventually of kind of working itself into my awareness and my dreams.
You don't even habituate to it because it's always on thing. I mean, you do habituate to sounds, but something that's in your head is perceived differently than something that you can tell is quiet enough that it's down the block. And tinnitus is very underappreciated for such what a disruptive condition it is.
Right. It's kind of like having a little person with a little tiny nail and a little tiny chalkboard.
Yeah.
In your head. Just kind
of... Yeah, I have a friend who said any kind of noise will set his off, and his is louder than anything else in the environment. So he called up and said, look, my office air conditioning sets off my tinnitus. By the end of the day, it's the loudest thing in my head.
Right. Yeah, it's always the loudest. It's always the loudest thing I'm hearing if I'm paying attention to it. And that's always my hope is I can get away from it. But I just had to mention that in light of what you were saying earlier. Again, the universal sense, how hearing shapes the mind. Dr. Seth Horowitz is a researcher at Brown University, and he's also the co-founder of NeuroPop, the first sound design and consulting firm to use neurosensory and psychophysical algorithms in music, sound design, and sonic branding. You're going to have to explain that coming up, okay? Because that sounds really forward-thinking, and I really love that. It's futuristic. So we'll get to that coming up in just a minute then, exactly what that is. And then we'll have to get back to the questions, too. We mentioned about the fingernails on the chalkboard. But at some point tonight, I think I mentioned city folks who have trouble sleeping in the country and vice versa. And then we'll ask the bat question as well. All of those coming up next hour with Dr. Seth Horowitz, the universal sense. If you want to keep in touch with me in between these monthly appearances now, that's what I'm down to on Coast to Coast. Please do that via Twitter. I'm at Deacon Punnett, DEACONPUNNETT, at Deacon Punnett at Twitter. Love to hear from you all. Write back all the time. And I love to send out funny photos and other stuff that I collect during the week. So if you're on, make sure I'm on with you. And take a look at all that great merchandise that's up tonight, too, at coasttocoastam.com. The new Coast to Coast merchandise for the merch with T-shirts and hats and the new coffee mugs and stuff, especially for you insomniacs, you know? be proud about it. If you're up, might as well be boasting. You're up and you're listening to the best overnight radio show in the country. Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Ponet.